from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in forums next hour, on Monday, futurist and visionary inventor Ray Kurzweil joined Google as its new director of engineering to work on projects related to machine learning and language processing. We'll talk to Kurzweil about his new position and his latest book, How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. Join us next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this hour of our forum program. Ray Kurzweil invented the software underlying Siri and the first practical system for speech recognition and text scanning. A technologist and futurist, he's also author of The Age of Spirituality, Machines, and The Singularity is Near. And he was named on Monday as new chief of engineering at Google. His most recent book is How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. He's a recipient of the National Medal of Technology and a member of the Inventors Hall of Fame. Fortune magazine called him the ultimate thinking machine, and his story and singularity theory made the cover of Time magazine. Ray Kurzweil joins us on this forum hour, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Glad to have you here, and congratulations on the new position with
Thanks.
Google. Actually, let's begin with that. I imagine you're going to be involved in all kinds of things with machine learning and language processing projects, but also artificial intelligence?
Right. I mean, artificial intelligence will be the main focus. I've been thinking about thinking for 50 years. That's reflected in the new book you mentioned that just came out. And Google, of course, has a lot of efforts in artificial intelligence, but I will be heading up an effort and coordinating with other research to really bring AI into Google's products. You know, right now when people create a web page or a page of a book, they're not creating a bag of words. They're creating something that has, you know, a whole hierarchy of semantic meaning. And a lot of that is lost to computers. They're not able to benefit from that information and knowledge. That's the era that we're now entering. Go out a few years and search engines and other programs will really be reading all this material out on the web for meaning, and you'll be able to search semantically. It will understand you know, what you're really looking for and understand the web pages that you're searching for, and it'll bring a much higher level of access to knowledge.
Well, since you mentioned the word hierarchy, it brings me right to your book, which is all about pattern recognition theory of the mind and a hierarchical set of patterns that we recognize as in, for example, when we read words. This is a theory of the mind that brings us right square to the neocortex, doesn't it?
Right. Well, the neocortex is that, you know, recent evolutionary development that started with mammals a few hundred million years ago, and it's capable of thinking in hierarchies, which reflects the natural hierarchical structure of the world. And these hierarchies are flexible, so you can recognize patterns at different levels of abstraction, and you can recognize a pattern even if it's not completely there or if it's just hinted at. There's a lot of flexibility in thinking with a neocortex. If you don't have a neocortex, then you can only do pre-programmed behaviors. Now, hundreds of millions of years ago, that was okay. The environment changed very slowly. It would take thousands of years for an environmental change to occur. And so animals without a neocortex could adapt over thousands of generations through biological evolution to change their pre-programmed behaviors over thousands of years. Then 65 million years ago, a catastrophic event occurred. It's called the Cretaceous Extinction Event, and we see geological evidence of that all around the world. Something dramatic happened. We think it had to do with a meteor, but the environment changed everywhere in the world. And there were these little, you know, early mammals, rodent-like creatures. They had a neocortex. They could think in a hierarchical fashion. They could learn new skills in a matter of days rather than thousands of years. And so that's when mammals sort of took over their ecological niche, and tens of thousands of non-mammalian species died out. And to anthropomorphize, the biological evolution said, hey, this neocortex is pretty good stuff. And it started to grow it as mammals evolved, and we got more complex, higher-level mammals like primates, for example, that had a larger and larger neocortex. And finally, Homo sapiens showed up, and we have this big forehead that could squeeze in more neocortex. So we could even think higher-level, more abstract thoughts. That was actually the enabling factor for art and science and language, having, you know, this larger neocortex. And that's where we do our thinking. It's today, you know, in Homo sapiens, it's 80% of our brain, so it's really where the action is. We still have that old brain that provides things like sexual attraction and aggression, but it's all mediated by this neocortex we have. So, you know, when the old brain senses fear, it actually has to get those signals from the neocortex that will actually figure out that there's something to be afraid of. The neocortex is where the action is. And I describe how it works, and it does work in this hierarchical fashion. We can talk more about that.
It works like an algorithm, essentially.
Well, right. I talk about the algorithm of the neocortex, and there's actually one basic method for each module. And we have about 300 million modules, and they're very similar. There's subtle changes across the modules, but basically they run the same algorithm. And in fact, the uniformity of the neocortex was first noticed by a neuroscientist, Vernon Mountcastle, about 50 years ago. But we now actually can see inside a living brain with enough precision, because that's been another exponential trend. The spatial resolution of brain scanning has been doubling every year. And we can see your brain create your thoughts, and we can see your thoughts create your brain. That's really the secret of human thought, in that we actually create this hierarchy with our own thoughts. And we have 300 million modules, each of which can recognize a pattern. So some of these patterns are at a low level of the hierarchy, like recognizing the crossbar and a capital A. And those modules, all they get excited about is when they see a crossbar and a capital A, they get very excited and they send a high probability out on the output axon of that module. At the opposite end of the opposite extreme of the continuum of abstractness, I have pattern recognizers that will trigger if something is funny or if she's pretty or if something's ironic. You probably think that those high-level pattern recognizers are much more sophisticated and complicated. They're actually the same, but they're getting input from higher-level pattern recognizers. They sit on top of this very elaborate hierarchy. Whereas the pattern recognizers that are dealing with, let's say, the edges of objects and shadings and so on are at very low levels. And that hierarchy is actually built with real connections, real axons and dendrites. And we actually grow those and connect those in reflection to our thoughts. And so we actually build those connections, establishing that hierarchy from the moment we're born or even earlier, because our eyes open at 26 weeks in utero. And everybody has a very different hierarchy and set of connections in the neocortex, reflecting, you know, the very different experiences we have. So you are very much what you think, not just what you eat.
Oh, so it reminds me of an interview I had many years ago with Francis Crick, when he said, we are just all neurons. And that's kind of what not only constitutes our emotions and our moral judgment and our thinking, but you talk about spindle cells, though.
Well, spindle cells are cells in the neocortex. They have a unique property in that they can span the entire neocortex. They can be inches long, which is long, and since our brain is only inches wide. And so they can connect very disparate parts of our neocortex, and they're organized in kind of an arbitrary fashion, so they're not very rational, which is why some of our emotions are not that logical. But I will say that our emotional intelligence, the ability to be funny, to get the joke, to be sexy, to express a loving sentiment, that's not some kind of sideshow to human intelligence. That is actually the cutting edge of human intelligence. That's the most intelligent thing we do. if we were to say that, no, intelligence is just logical thinking and thinking things through in a rational manner. If that were true, then computers already exceed human intelligence.
If that were true, we wouldn't have work by Dan Goleman or the Dalai Lama collaborating and talking about emotional intelligence. Yeah.
Right. So being, you know, being funny or understanding any of these high-level human emotions and being able to respond in an appropriate emotional way, that's the most complicated thing we do. But they actually are part of the same neocortex. They just sit on top of this very elaborate hierarchy, a hierarchy that our neocortex creates itself as we grow older. I mean, I have a 15-month-old grandson now, and he has successfully laid down several layers of patterns. So he can begin to understand little bits of language, and we also use that for physical movement, so he can walk now. And we keep laying down actually one conceptual level at a time.
Well, get him working with erector sets like you did as a kid, Ray. I read about that.
Well, he's got plenty of stimulating toys like that. But it is very important actually to stimulate children by reading to them, even if they don't fully understand the meaning of the words, as many levels of language that they can respond to, you know, even at 6 or 9 months old. And one interesting thing is we fill up those 300 million pattern recognizers by the time we're about 20 or earlier. So to learn something new at that point, we have to learn the art of forgetting. And part of that forgetting can come from redundancy because, like for I mentioned, I've got pattern recognizers that recognize the crossbar and a capital A. You know, at one point I probably had thousands of those, but my brain realized we don't really need that much redundancy, so we could free up some of those to learn new material. Some people don't do that very well, and that's why some people are rigid thinkers and don't learn new things and just rely on what they've already learned. It's also why a child, like a 5-year-old, can learn a new language so easily because they have all this virgin neocortex that can get filled up with new patterns.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Ray Kurzweil, who is now was named Monday officially Director of Engineering at Google. He's the author of a new book called How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. Some of this notion of pattern recognition theory of mind brings me back to Jeff Hawkins, the Palm Pilot inventor.
Well, the thesis I present in this book is consistent with Hawkins' thesis. He also has a hierarchy for the neocortex. There are some differences in the actual algorithm that's used in this hierarchy, and I explain that in the book. It actually goes back to work in the 80s and 90s that I was involved in. I helped pioneer a technique called hierarchical hidden Markov models. That's fairly technical sounding, but it was also we would build these computerized systems that were built in a hierarchy, and it could, for example, recognize human speech and even do limited forms of natural language understanding by organizing the information in a hierarchical fashion.
So how about building a computer model of this? I mean, when you go to Google, you could reverse engineering of the brain, couldn't you?
Well, you know, the brain is a source of what I would call biologically inspired methods. And one of the reasons we want to reverse engineer the brain is to provide these models with which we can build better artificial intelligence. We'll also have better means of fixing the brain. Already we can connect computers into the brain, for example, Parkinson's patients, and the latest generation of that neural implant allows you to download new software to the computer inside your body, connected into your brain from outside the patient. And also it'll give us more insight into ourselves. If you ask what is the fundamental purpose of art and science, it's to understand ourselves, know thyself. Well, a very important part of ourselves is our brain. How do we think? And understanding and reverse engineering the human brain gives us greater insight into that. But yes, you know, I've been thinking about thinking for 50 years. I actually wrote a paper 50 years ago that's not that different from my book in broad strokes, and that it said that the essence of human intelligence is pattern recognition, and we have a lot of pattern recognizers in our brain, and that's what we're good at. We're not good at logical thinking. That was my Westinghouse Science Talent Search submission, and I got to meet President Johnson, and So I've been thinking about this for 50 years. But yes, understanding the human brain will help give us better methods to create intelligent machines, you know, using ourselves as a model. And it's only recently that we can begin to do that. Interestingly, the techniques we used in the 80s and 90s and that are very powerful and common today in artificial intelligence are similar mathematically to what I described takes place in the brain. But the reason for that is not that we were consciously trying to copy the brain. We just kind of discovered these techniques work. And you could say that biological evolution discovered the same thing when it evolved the brain. But now that we can actually see inside a living brain with enough precision to see these new connections forming that reflect these new interconnections in the hierarchy of our neocortex, we can actually build accurate models and then use those models to build more intelligent machines and then use those intelligent machines to make ourselves smarter. So, you know, Google already makes us smarter and Wikipedia and all of these brain extenders. I felt like a part of my brain went on strike during that one-day SOPA strike. These are extensions of our brain already. As they become more intelligent, we're making ourselves more intelligent. That's
what about that book, Google Making Us More Stupid? I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about it. We had the author on. I was not the host that day. But there are people who say, gee, I can look at Google now. I can look up information. I don't have to depend on my own consciousness or my own brain to go fetch the information.
Yes. Well, you know, you need to keep in mind that Google's not going away. I remember the same controversy when I went to college. There were these new little devices. They look like phones today. They were called calculators, and there were four-function calculators, and then there was a big deal, a five-function calculator with a memory key, and controversy was kids aren't going to learn arithmetic anymore. And indeed, you know, arithmetic skills, doing long division or doing square roots, you know, with pen and paper, has gone down. But the calculators haven't gone away, and the search engines aren't going away. And these are purposely extensions of our brain. In my view, our intelligence is humanity equipped with our technology, with our brain extenders. There's no question we're smarter as a result. I've been managing work groups for 45 years. I can have a group of three or four people do in weeks what used to take 100 people years. We're much more productive and intelligent because we can access all of human knowledge with a few keystrokes. A kid in Africa walking on a dirt road with a smartphone, and they're increasingly ubiquitous in the developing world, has access to more intelligent information and intelligent search than the President of the United States did 15 or 20 years ago. These are very empowering technologies, and we created these tools to extend our reach physically and mentally and overcome our limitations. So perhaps we're stupider if you were to take all the technology away, but that's not happening.
No, I know. In fact, you've been called a technological evangelist and have said that the technological evolution is moving probably a million times faster than the biological, and have pointed out on many occasions that a brave new world is ahead, and want to talk with you about some of that. But I'm also struck by and can't help thinking about the cat detector that Google, the pattern recognizer, which gets us right back to a lot of what you're writing about here, analyzing, you know, 10 million YouTube videos and recognizing cats and faces. But then they had that larger sample of some 20,000 categories that fell below 16%.
Well, that was a particular experiment where it tried to learn without any labeling. In other words, none of the input data was labeled as to what was a cat. And I don't think actually, if you took humans who had never seen a cat and then asked them to identify cats but never told them what a cat looked like, they wouldn't do very well either. So it was actually an impressive result in a somewhat artificial situation. My belief in artificial intelligence is you do have to tell the AI, just like you have to tell human children what the truth is. And so, you'll show a human child, you know, books and real life animals and say this is a cat and this is a dog, and that's actually how human children learn. If you do that with computers, you can get very good accuracy as well. Speech recognition now is in fact amazingly accurate. I started working on that field 30 years ago.
Yeah, you were a pioneer. What about Watson the computer, though? I mean, this is an AI system which won in Jeopardy, got a lot of media coverage, but it's actually many systems, wasn't it?
Watson is very significant. Yes, it has many components. In fact, the IBM scientists took many dozens of different programs which could do some level of a job at recognizing natural language, and they put them all together, and they had a framework that could assess which ones did well and in which situations. But if you look at the overall success of Watson, it is actually understanding human language at some level, enough of a level to have gotten a higher score than the best two human players put together on a game which is not a narrow task. It's a very broad task involving subtle forms of language with puns and metaphors and similes and jokes and riddles. And it didn't get its knowledge by being programmed in some language like Lisp with all of those facts. It actually got its knowledge by reading Wikipedia and several other encyclopedias, 200 million pages of natural language documents, which it read well enough to, you know, answer these queries and do quite well. It made some stupid mistakes, but it also, you know, got some fantastic things right. Like, for example, a long, tiresome speech delivered by a frothy pie topping. It correctly responded, what is a meringue harangue? The two humans were stumped, and that's pretty impressive if you think about it. And it got a lot of other really obscure queries correct. It got some easy ones wrong, so did the humans. But it's showing a level of natural language of understanding of documents. And if you were to give it one document and give you and I one document, you and I would do a better job than Watson of understanding what's on that page. However, Watson can then use what's called computer scale. It read 200 million pages and has total recall of that and can access it all in 3 seconds. You and I can't do that. And, you know, IBM is now applying Watson to all of medical literature, reading every journal and every new journal article that comes out and medical blogs, and to create a medical diagnostician and consulting system. That's where we're headed. And it shows the feasibility of understanding human language. And that's what I'm going to be working on at Google, is actually Google has these fantastic databases, and the goal is to actually understand what's on the page and be able to help users, you know, by actually understanding natural language.
We're talking to Ray Kurzweil, and again, he has a new book out called How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. Other books include The Singularity is Near and The Age of Spiritual Machines. And I'm going to open the phone lines and invite those of you who are listening to bring your questions and comments to the fore, and also to join in this conversation. And he is, as I said earlier, the new director of engineering at Google, was named to that position on Monday, and is certainly a globally admired visionary and inventor and futurist, often looking at things on the positive side. We'll even talk about some of his predictions throughout the course of this hour. AI by 2029, we're standing by for that. Immortality, perhaps the most controversial prediction of Ray Kurzweil's, by 2045. Let me hear from you, though, and you can join us at our toll-free number right now at 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your involvement in the conversation and your calls. Toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. You can also post any questions or comments you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum, click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll continue after a brief break. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. On Monday, futurist, author, visionary, inventor Ray Kurzweil joined Google as its new director of engineering, working on projects related to machine learning and language processing. We're talking with him about his new position and about his newest book, How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. And I'm going to go to your calls and get our listeners involved in this forthwith here. A couple of things, though, Ray, before I do that, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up sort of two lines that I'm curious to get your response to. And they both have to do with criticism of your work. One, the book that we're talking about, the new book that's out there, but the second, perhaps more, well, the visionary futurist Ray Kurzweil. Let's talk about that first. I mean, there are those who say you know, there's a darker side of technology, and they see you as the technology upbeat, optimist, sanguine viewer of its future. Thinking about doomsday viruses, where are jobs going to come from, population carrying capacity, and all those kinds of things, which maybe, you know, I don't mean to present them all in a grab bag here, but certainly in many people's minds dampen the idea that technology is leading us to a brave new world that's going to be one of good vistas.
Well, ironically, actually, I've written more about the downsides of technology than most other observers. There was a famous article, cover story in Wired magazine, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us by Bill Joy, which was based entirely on my book, The Age of Spiritual Machines. I've got an extensive discussion in Singularities Near called The Deeply Intertwined Promise Versus Peril of GNR, which is Genetics, Nanotechnology, and Robotics. The downsides you mentioned actually are not the ones that concern me so much. I mean, the same technologies we're applying to increase information technology are also going to increase resources. In fact, Larry Page of Google and I did a study for the National Academy of Engineering on energy resources and noted that solar energy is doubling every 2 years. It's on an exponential rise. It's now about 1% or over 1% of the world's energy needs. People dismiss it, 1% is just a fringe player, just like they dismiss the internet when it was 1% or the Genome Project when it was 1%, ignoring the exponential growth. It's only seven doublings from 100%. We have 10,000 times more sunlight than we need to do that. There's a similar story on water and new food production techniques, so-called vertical agriculture. It would take us a long time to talk about all these. There are dangers, though. The most salient one, for example, in biotech, we're reprogramming the information processes underlying biology away from disease. So we'll have dramatic new treatments, I believe, for things like heart disease and cancer over the next decade as a result. But the same technology could enable a bioterrorist in a routine college bioengineering lab to take a benign virus, say a routine cold or flu virus, and reprogram it to be much more deadly or communicable or stealthy, create a super weapon. I've actually worked on that problem with the U.S. Army, and there is now a rapid response system to deal with that. That doesn't mean we can cross it off our list.
I don't think you can cross off the jobs that are disappearing either. I mean, Jeremy Rifkin may have been somewhat of a Cassandra on that score, but...
I really reject that notion. That started 200 years ago with the Luddites. It was very clear to them that jobs were going away because, you know, one person with these new, you know, cotton spinning machines and weaving machines could do the work of 20 people. But in fact, employment increased and prosperity increased. If I were a prescient futurist in 1900, I would say a third of you work on farms and a third of you work in factories. That was the state of employment in the United States in 1900. But I predict that in 100 years, by the year 2000, it'll be 3% and 3%. And that's what happened. And now it's actually 2% and 2%. And yet a higher percentage of the population is working. The new jobs, 65% of, in fact, all employment now is in creating information in one form of another, like yourself creating a radio program. And these jobs pay eight times as much in constant dollars. We've created more jobs just in numbers than we've eliminated through this type of automation. And the new jobs require more education. So we've gone from 50,000 college students in 1870 to over 12 million today. We spend 10 times as much in constant dollars per capita on K-12 education to provide the higher skills for these higher level jobs. And that's going to continue to happen. But I couldn't have been very comforting in 1900 because people say, well, what are these new jobs? And I say, I have no idea. They haven't been invented yet. You're going to be designing websites and chips and doing online forums, and nobody would have any idea what I'm talking about. That'll be true in the future, too. There'll be new jobs that we can't even imagine today. And if you could imagine them, then you should become an entrepreneur and take advantage of that insight. Idea that automation eliminates jobs has been going on for 200 years, and it does eliminate jobs, but it creates new jobs that actually are more rewarding jobs. Most employment 100 years ago was not a source of satisfaction or life definition.
Ray, can I get you to give some quick response to some of the criticism that has come your way in light of the new book? I'd be curious to know what you have to say. We've got lots of people who want to talk to you, and I want to get as many of them on here with you as I can. But like I said, I think it would be remiss not to get a response from you. Gary Marcus, a neuroscientist who's been featured on this program, who wrote Guitar Zero, did a whole almost kind of a hit piece in The New Yorker, and Doug Hofstadter has written. Essentially, they feel that you've got good ideas mixed up with some ideas
that
are wild.
One piece was, that one piece was nonsense. I mean, there's been...
Which one piece?
Nothing.
You're talking about Marcus?
The New Yorker piece. I mean, there's been nothing but positive reviews. That piece is, he quotes some people, calls them scientists who are not scientists. Hofstadter made this vulgar comment 12 years ago about my work and Moravec's work, which I won't even repeat. And it's a content-free ad hominem attack that is not actually a criticism that has any substance to it.
Well, let me characterize a little bit of that content, because otherwise we're talking about something that listeners may not be aware of. In the case of Marcus, he said, you know, you sort of ignored, from his perspective, anthropology and language and psychology particularly.
I don't know what that means. I mean, I talk about those subjects extensively. I mean, that was really a content-free piece that had no real arguments in it, didn't present any of my views and didn't argue against them. It just had a lot of...
What about the argument that the view of the mind has to take into consideration a struggle with self-control? That was in Marcus's piece.
I don't know what that has to do with my thesis. I mean, we have lots of different... parts of our neocortex, we can have inconsistent thoughts because there's no, I talk about this extensively in the book, there's nothing in the neocortex that requires all ideas to be consistent. So you might have somebody that expounds eloquently on tolerance and equality of peoples and then also harbors prejudiced views, and there's nothing in the brain that prevents this kind of inconsistency. We have a very weak technique of critical thinking, where we're supposed to actually go through our neocortex and see if it's consistent, but most people don't exercise that very much. I talk about that extensively. But I mean, I present a very specific thesis about the neocortex.
That you do.
That review doesn't discuss it at all. It just... I really have nothing further to say about it.
All right. Well, let's bring our callers in, and they've been waiting patiently to talk to you. We'll start, CJ, with you. You're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm so excited to talk with you both. Thank you for taking my call. I have a mental illness, and I would like to... I have unipolar depression. I've tried all kinds of treatments, and I'm really excited about medicine and technology coming together at long last. So I'd like to hear what artificial intelligence can do for me in the future. And then secondly, my second question and last question is, you know, I grew up watching Star Trek, and they had these things that they talked into, and now we have cell phones, flip phones, same thing, you know. And then there was the Borg, and when do we become more machine than man, basically, is my question. And I'm actually looking forward to the future and technology in the future.
I mean, I think one of the reasons we want to understand the human brain and reverse engineer it is to do a better job of fixing it. The drugs we typically give for psychiatric conditions, they certainly can be a godsend, and many of them work very well for some patients. They treat the brain as kind of a chemical soup and address certain imbalances, but then they affect all of the brain. Rather than treating it as the network that it truly is, technologies like the neural implant for Parkinson's, and there are neural implants being developed for many other conditions, begin to actually treat it as a network and more selectively apply interventions where there's a problem. We have a ways to go to address sort of pervasive psychiatric conditions. using this technique, but that's one of the benefits we'll have through reverse engineering the brain, and the progress is exponential. We're gaining more and more knowledge at a faster and faster pace, and we can actually see inside the brain now. We can actually begin to put circuitry inside the brain. And as I say, there are actually a couple dozen different types of neural implants being experimented with. We can put the neural implants now not just in one spot in the brain, but increasingly in multiple places. There are some ambitious projects to put them in hundreds of places. So I think over the next decade, and certainly two decades, you'll see major innovations that go beyond just the drug treatments we have today.
Let me thank CJ for her call and go right to another caller. That's you, Peter. Join us.
Oh, thank you. Good morning, gentlemen. For the benefit of other listeners, I'm sure also, could you elaborate, sir, on the singularity that you mentioned in your title? And you briefly referred to it in this conversation, but it whizzed by pretty fast.
Well, the singularity is a metaphor borrowed from physics for a singular, if you will, change coming in human history. And the metaphor we're borrowing is from physics. If you have a black hole, which is a physics singularity, there's an event horizon around it, and it's hard to see beyond the event horizon. But we can actually use our logical thinking to think about the implications of what's beyond the event horizon. So it's a similar phenomenon here. And specifically, what's going to happen is we're going to be merging with our technology. As I mentioned earlier, the early steps of that are already happening. Even the devices you carry from your belt and hold in your hand are extensions of who we are and make us smarter. These ultimately will go inside our bodies and brains and really extend human intelligence. And go out to 2045, we'll be expanding our capability a billion-fold, according to my calculations, through these brain extenders. In my view, we're still human because we are already a human-machine civilization. We're the only species that seeks to overcome our limitations with our inventions. And that's growing in an exponential manner, and ultimately exponential growth is quite explosive.
I think you just answered a question.
We'll get to a point where the changes are so transformative, we use this metaphor from physics to describe it.
I think you just answered a question of a listener who says, does technology singularity mean computer artificial intelligence beyond the scope of human thought or the melding of man and machine into a superhuman?
It's both. I mean, we already can do things that we couldn't do before. Recently, mathematicians using collaborative software were able to solve a problem that had remained unsolved for over a century. And it was really a combination of human and machine processes. And we do things routinely now that couldn't possibly be done without our technology. And the technology is growing exponentially. Our natural intelligence is not. You mentioned earlier that technological evolution's moving a million times faster, and that's true. So you go out 50 years from now, our biological brains won't be that different, but our technology will be trillions of times more powerful. It's still the human-machine civilization.
We're extending on Gordon Moore here, aren't we, in terms of exponential factors?
Well, Gordon Moore and Moore's law is not synonymous with my law of accelerating returns. It's an example of it. My law of accelerating returns is that information technology is growing exponentially. Every form of information technology, not just computers, but communications, biological technologies, our knowledge of the brain. And Moore's law is just one example of that. In fact, it's not even synonymous with exponential growth in computers. It only started when we had chips. Moore's law is that chips get more powerful, approximately double in power every year, because we can put more transistors on a chip. And that's just one example of many of how we've actually brought greater power to computers.
And a question a couple questions on singularity. Eric asks, can Dr. Kurzweil say why his film on singularity never came out after all the media buildup? It was called The Singularity Is Near. It did play many festivals, but what happened with that, Ray?
That is out, and it had a very successful festival tour, as you mentioned, won awards. It played at some of the major festivals around the world, and that is out. You can get a high-definition download or get it on DVD. There's been showings at different theaters, but right now you can get it either online or through DVD. So if you just Google "The Singularity Is Near" movie, you'll get it.
Well, that's good news. Another listener on our website writes, I'm inclined to agree with James Kunstler's criticism of Kurzweil and too much magical thinking. We are already seeing the effects of our population having exceeded the carrying capacity of Earth, and the economic and resource implications of that are already being felt. I would not stake my grandchildren's lives on achieving any singularity.
Well, read what I've written, for example, on solar energy. Which, as I mentioned earlier, is doubling every 2 years, and is less than seven doublings from meeting 100% of our energy needs, and it's being pushed forward by applying nanotechnology to solar panels. The costs, both installed and of just PPV, is coming down at a very rapid rate. We have 10,000 times more sunlight than we need to do that. There are new water technologies, like Dean Kamen's water machine. There are new food production technologies, vertical agriculture, all of which are going to grow exponentially. We are running out of resources if and only if you limit your thinking to 19th century technologies like fossil fuels. If you use the new 21st century technologies that are emerging, we have more than enough resources. And in fact, what we see as countries get more prosperous, which is one effect of the technological advance we see, they stop growing their population.
Wonder what you say to a listener named Stephen who writes, regarding Dr. Kurzweil's description of the singularity, where it seems open to criticism is, it makes the assumption that future rates of progress will be identical to current rates, and this extrapolation assumption is the kind of mistake that folks like Malthus made in his population predictions. Could he address that criticism?
Well, I mean, should try reading Singularity Is Near, because it addresses that issue and talks both theoretically and empirically why, when it comes to information technology, it progresses exponentially. And when one paradigm, like, for example, Moore's Law comes to an end, another paradigm picks up the pace. Moore's Law was not the first, but the fifth paradigm to bring exponential growth to computing. Go back to the 1890 census and see very smooth exponential rise of computation, completely unaffected by things like World War I, World War II, the Cold War, the Great Depression, the recent recession. And there are ultimate limits in terms of what we know about physics and the amount of matter and energy it takes to compute a bit or remember a bit or transmit a bit, and I talk about that. But these limits will not come into bear until late in this century, at which point we'll need to actually expand beyond the Earth to keep this going. But at that point, these technologies will be trillions of times more powerful than unaided human thinking. And indeed, human thinking is already not unaided. We are already much smarter than we used to be because of these brain extenders.
Ray Kurzweil with us this morning. How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed is his new book. And James, you're our next caller. Join us. James?
Yeah, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to get an opinion on this. I think that hormones and the chemicals in our brains that reward us actually drive our behavior. And do you think that artificial intelligence will actually achieve that?
Well, these are coming from the old brain, and the old brain hasn't gone away. So it provides fear and aggression and sexual desire. But these are then mediated and sublimated by the neocortex. As I mentioned earlier, we don't know what to be afraid of unless the neocortex tells us that something dangerous is afoot.
Can often tell us something's dangerous that's afoot, which is not afoot, though, can it? I mean, we recognize...
May not be.
Like a paranoid brain, let's say.
Sure. I mean, in fact, one of the benefits of reverse engineering the brain is we'll not only understand human function, but human dysfunction. But the neocortex also can sublimate are aggression. So you might have a desire to be aggressive, but that then gets translated into writing a poem or a symphony or inventing a new product. Or a sexual desire gets converted into all kinds of, you know, activities.
Playing dodgeball. That's what they used to do up at Boonville at the Mooney Camp.
Yeah. So we have a neocortex that sublimates the old brain. And so we're not subject to just pre-programmed behaviors, which was the case for animals prior to the mammalian neocortex.
We're joined this hour again, if you've just joined us, by Ray Kurzweil, whose new book is How to Create the Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. He will be Google's chief engineer, and he'll also be appearing, I know there are many Kurzweil fans out there, as part of Cal Performances at Wheeler Auditorium in Berkeley on the 13th of April. But let me go to some more of your emails here. Alexandra writes, I take exception to the assertion of technology increasing intelligence. Access to information through a device is not equivalent to intellect. Retention of information and ability to apply ideas and concepts are better indicators.
Well, what they're doing so far is enabling us to use our intelligence on the highest levels of the creation of knowledge. If you go back 50 years or 100 years or 200 years, you'll see that most human labor was devoted to meeting the basic needs of life and to providing the means to ever actually have a moment to do something creative. Very few people actually had that opportunity, certainly not in their professional lives. Today, 65% of all workers are knowledge workers and have all these tools to do a lot of the routine work which otherwise took up all of our time. So we're being freed to use our neocortex at the highest level of abstraction. And ultimately, as we actually build the equivalent systems that are hierarchical and can themselves reflect hierarchical thinking, they'll actually enable us to think at even higher conceptual levels. If you think about the fact that biologically speaking, this addition of the forehead and the frontal cortex, that additional neocortex, was the enabling factor that led to a qualitative leap of inventing language and art and science that came from this greater quantity of neocortex. Because we have, you know, a bit more than the other primates. They don't have this frontal cortex. And those other primates did not invent language or technology or science or art. Just think what we'll be able to do, what qualitative leaps we'll take as we add even more by extending our neocortex, by merging with the technology we're creating, which will be built in its image.
It's a lot of range and diversity, though, of intelligence. I mean, there are some humans who almost have, intelligence off the scale. I would put Ray Kurzweil as one of them. And then you have humans who are maybe down almost with reptilian types or small mammals.
Well, not exactly. You know, we all have a very similar structure, but we build that hierarchy ourselves with our own experiences. And as I mentioned, different parts of your neocortex aren't necessarily aligned with each other. They can have opposing ideas. So Minsky had a nice metaphor, which was the title of one of his books, Society of Mind. If you think of one brain as a society, how effective are societies? If one society has different factions that are fighting each other all the time, that society isn't going to be very effective at accomplishing anything. If another society where everybody works together harmoniously, they could accomplish great things. So that's a metaphor in thinking about how different brains work. But also, some brains are organized for different things. So Mozart's brain was, you know, through his genetic dispositions and the influence of his family, which was very musical, had a genius for music. And Einstein actually was interested in music, but he was no Yasha Heifetz. Yasha Heifetz had an interest in physics, but he was no Einstein. We organize our neocortex differently. And, you know, that's the sort of magic, if you will, of human diversity.
We've got about a minute left here, and I need to ask you about the prediction of immortality by 2045. Still stand by it?
Well, what I'm predicting specifically is about 15 years from now, we'll be adding more time than is going by through the advance of science and understanding and re-engineering our biology. And that's not a guarantee, because life expectancy is a statistical phenomenon. You could get hit by the proverbial bus tomorrow, although 10 years from now, you know, cars and buses will be, you know, using technology like the Google self-driving cars, and so we, even that will be mitigated. But we'll get to a point where scientific advance is so rapid that we're adding more time to your remaining life expectancy than is passing. And the sands of time will start running in. It'll change the metaphor. It's not a guarantee. Ultimately, we'll have that decision in our own metaphorical hands rather than the hands of fate.
Always fascinating talking to you. Appreciate very much your spending this hour with us. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Ray Kurzweil, again, his new book, How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed, and he will be in charge of engineering at Google. It was announced just on Monday. Excuse me. Still have this cold to get rid of here. Thank you for being with us these 2 hours of Forum. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And you can always continue to have conversations on our website, kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page. And we do welcome thoughts from you about what you hear on Forum. You can call us, 415-553-3300, and let us know your thoughts. Or again, go to our Facebook page or email us, forum@kqed.org. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And our interns are Bradley Davis, Reva Gold, Nora McCartan, and Gina Shalaba. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.